From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. You're listening to funeral services in Baltimore for the late Congressman Elijah E. Cummings.
That funeral today put a pause on the impeachment inquiry, which will continue tomorrow. And we're learning today that the Justice Department review of the Russia investigation has become a criminal inquiry. Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable, Univision News anchor Enrique Acevedo. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Jeremy.
And ABC News political director Rick Klein. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
So let's start with that criminal investigation. We now know that Attorney General William Barr's review of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation, which President Trump has been calling a witch hunt, is a criminal investigation. Here's the White House counselor Kellyanne Conway on Fox News this morning, asked whether Department of Justice was being used as a tool for political retribution.
No, the point of the investigation is to make sure that the DOJ and the FBI under the Obama administration in 2016 was not being used as a tool to influence the elections.
Rick, what's going on here?
This is the president getting his wish. He has long said that he viewed the actions by FBI, DOJ officials, including the fired FBI director, James Comey, to be criminal. Now he gets to find out if that's the case or not. And so this investigation has morphed into another phase that is very explicitly looking backwards to see if any criminal conduct happened. Now, a lot of people are going to point out there's no way that this can be an impartial investigation, given the president's stated preferences publicly and privately that the DOJ look at itself. But the investigation of the investigators is now criminal.
Is there anything that you can think of in the past when the Department of Justice was being used in a way, it appears, because they are doing exactly what President Trump has been asking for, in a way that appears so political? Enrique.
Well, I think the impartiality part of the argument that Rick just mentioned, it's the most important part to understand what's going on right now. We need to trust that this investigation is not being conducted because of a political purpose. And we need to know that the incentive is there to really, go after the responsibilities, if there are any, under the rule of law, under the principles and the values of our judicial system. So what worries me about this is that there's no trust in the institution, and there's no trust in the Attorney General right now, and there's no trust that he can be impartial on this, and so it turns political. I can't think of another of a president, at least not in our modern history, as to something like this.
Enrique and Rick, let's talk impeachment. President Trump's latest defense on impeachment is that there was no proven quid pro quo because Ukraine didn't know that U.S. military aid was being held up in exchange for Ukraine conducting investigations of Democrats. But there's been reporting this week that Ukraine actually did know. How is the administration doing in its defense at this point, do you think, Enrique?
Well, it has turned into process. The arguments about what happened now are clearer because of the testimony that the House Commission, the Intelligence and the Foreign Affairs Commissions have received in the past few days. So I think we have a better idea, a more clear idea of what happened between the U.S. government and the government of Ukraine and that sort of a shadow government that was run by Rudy Giuliani. So now that the arguments seem to center around the process in which this inquiry advances and evolves, I think that the administration has sort of laid out their cards on the table. They're not going to argue that the things that happened didn't happen. They're going to argue that the way that the House is conducting this is inappropriate.
Rick, I want to ask you a question about yesterday. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham introduced a non-binding resolution in the Senate to condemn House Democrats for holding witness depositions behind closed doors and not holding a vote on an impeachment inquiry. Here's some sound.
I'm not here to tell you that Donald Trump's done nothing wrong. I'm not here to tell you anything other than that the way they're going about it is really dangerous for the country.
And it's important to note that Republicans are represented in these closed-door hearings. But, Rick, why are Republicans focusing so much on the process And is this actually working for them?
Because they don't want to focus on the substance. A diminishing number of Republicans, Lindsey Graham even included, are in a position where they don't want to defend something that, in terms of the president's conduct, they view as indefensible. And that's why they focus on the process. And look, this is a stunt. It's not akin to the stunt of the House Republicans storming the secure conference room to try to make a highlight of this. But it is aimed at an audience of one, of President Trump, displaying some loyalty and of just trying to confuse matters a bit and hold things up. Maybe it works. Maybe Americans will be more concerned about the process rather than the substance. But ultimately, Democrats are – at some point they will open up the hearings. But until then, they feel like this is about amassing a body of evidence so they can take to the American people. And even if that's happening behind closed doors for the most part, there's precedent for that. And they feel like the ends will justify that means.
Well, and as Republicans on Capitol Hill focus on the process, a former Trump official, chief strategist Steve Bannon, this week launched a War Room podcast and radio show to give the White House a messaging strategy from the outside, which he feels is lacking on the inside. Today, his episode was focused on discrediting witnesses that are scheduled to testify next week.
But this is what the show is trying to do. We're trying to highlight these folks before they walk in there, because you're not going to see, CNN is going to give you, MSNBC is going to give you their version of it, the political weaponized version of this. We're trying to give you the more of a search for truth.
So he's trying to add his voice into the mix here. Rick, is the White House losing the messaging war when you think about it big picture with Bannon and Lindsey Graham and others? Is the White House losing the messaging war?
It feels like they're falling behind. You see that in public polling where more people are supporting the idea of an impeachment inquiry, even removal from office. And I think you see it in the concerns among Republicans that they do not have a very strong hand here. And it's because the president has played it as well. And it was only a week ago or so that Mick Mulvaney, in that infamous news conference, said, we don't need a war room because the president didn't do anything wrong. Well, guess what? They're getting war rooms. They're bunkering down, and they're trying to do what they can to message something that is very difficult to message.
Let's just switch gears here and talk about Syria. A lot of news there this week. President Trump declared the conflict between Turkey and the Kurds in Syria over. He lifted sanctions on Turkey. And today, the Pentagon Defense Secretary Mark Esper said some American troops will stay in Syria to protect oil fields. Enrique, we haven't heard since President Trump announced an end to this conflict the other day. We haven't heard as much criticism from Republicans. Your thoughts?
We were talking about process just now on the other issue, but what's lacking here, it seems it's process. The due process to make a decision, such an important decision for our national security, as to withdraw troops from Syria. And the more we hear and learn about the details of how this is happening and what can happen downstream, the more we know that there wasn't a process followed here in terms of what we've usually seen in the past in this type of decisions. So I think, this benefits all of our adversaries in the region. It benefits Russia. It benefits Iran. It certainly benefits ISIS. And it doesn't, at least not for the moment, reflect any sort of a benefit for our national mm-hmm. interest.
Let's talk 2020, the election. Ohio moderate Tim Ryan is out of the 2020 Democratic presidential race. Amy Klobuchar, she will take the debate stage next month. And now there are these four that are emerging: Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg. And former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp told us that she thinks Buttigieg can win Iowa. Rick, what will you be watching for over the next few weeks?
I think it's the revenge of the centrists and the moderates and the people that might represent that middle lane. Mayor Pete has been a big story since the last debate, and I think coming in to the next debate, the idea of not just him but Amy Klobuchar, who just qualified, do they pick up some momentum? Iowa, I think, is still wide open. Talking to Democrats, they don't know who's going to win Iowa. They know that Elizabeth Warren seems very strong in New Hampshire, and you can see how the state strategy plays out. I was struck by the decision by Joe Biden in his campaign to reverse course on super PACs and say they're open to getting big money. That's a signal of some concern and a move in the direction of practicality over any kind of idealism in the Democratic primary. But I think the Mayor Pete storyline is a real one.
Yeah, Enrique, I'm curious about your thoughts on this.
Well, it seems that, we're still a good few months away.
Three months.
Yes,
100
we are
days.
Very few months away.
But other candidates have had their chance. It feels like that. Elizabeth Warren had, you know, certainly saw a surge in the polls, and now that idea is sort of deflating a little bit. Kamala Harris at some point had the same opportunity. Let's see what happens with Mayor Pete, and if he takes makes this, takes it all the way, because certainly that idealism that Rick was referring to, it seems like the party is sort of settling for a candidate instead of rallying around this idea with enthusiasm and energy. Mayor Pete seems to have that at the moment. Let's see if he can take it all the way and make the most of this opportunity.
Rick, just in the 30 seconds we have, do you think we will have Halloween, maybe Brexit, Thanksgiving, impeachment hearings, Christmas, and then Iowa caucuses?
As long as we have a Nationals World Series win first, I'm good with all of that. It's going to be a really busy time. There's going to be a lot of storylines that are converging all at once.
And if the Nats go to Game 5, President Trump promises that he will go to the game on Sunday, which would be interesting because in Washington, D.C., he might not have such a crowd of people that loves him. We will see. Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision, Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
When I was a kid, I had an autograph book. I got it from Hallmark, and I had all of my friends put their signatures in it. I was a big basketball fan, and I had the goal of getting all of the signatures of the players on the Detroit Pistons. But in the age of Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, where selfies are the new currency, who carries an autograph book anymore? Well, the Public Library in Los Angeles has an exhibit of its autograph collection that has been turned into a new book, and we visited the exhibit to learn more about the lure of the autograph, that yearning to capture a piece of someone, and what it says about us. We're joined by exhibit curator and author of this new book, Josh Kuhn, director of the USC Annenberg School of Communication. Hi, Josh. Thanks for having us here.
Thank you for having me. But now I got to ask you, who was like the top Piston who you had to get the autograph from?
I never got Isaiah Thomas, and he was the main one back then.
So if you're listening, Isaiah Thomas. Yes.
Well, is it right to say that this autograph collection was started by one guy? Give us the history.
It was started by one guy who, like you, loved autographs and kept autograph books, Charles Lummis, and he sent out blank stationery to groups of people that he called people who count.
This all started in 1906, so we're talking famous people like America the Beautiful songwriter Catherine Lee Bates, Helen Keller, and painter James Carroll Beckwith. Lummis sent thousands of blank stationery to these people he thought counted. Entertainers, social reformers, zoologists, you name it. And hundreds of these folks actually wrote back.
A really wide range to his credit, and he sent out blank stationery and he said, send it back, but please improve upon this page. So it was an autograph, but really he left it open that it could be a signature, but it also could be watercolors, it could be excerpt from a speech, it could be all kinds of stuff, which indeed came through.
Josh takes me for a tour of the exhibit. Handwritten notes, letters, and photos on the walls of the first floor of the library. A welcome to folks who visit. And one letter catches my eye. Wow, we really don't see beautiful cursive like this anymore. Perfect penmanship back when that mattered. The dotting of the I's and the extravagant crossing of the T's. It's a poem about youth. We have tomorrow, it says, bright before us like a flame. And at the end, it's signed Langston Hughes, Los Angeles, 1935. And around the corner, a few pop cultural references.
What am I looking at here?
1939 animated short by the Walt Disney Company called The Autograph Hound, about a young, naive Donald Duck who wants to get everybody's autograph. Yeah. He breaks onto the film set and is trying to get autographs from all the celebrities and keeps failing. And we've got a couple images here of kind of classic Hollywood autograph moments.
Behind us is a huge book, almost like a scroll, a book of signatures.
put together for the Apollo 11 crew in 1969. And it was a project of a local LA radio station and the LA Times asking people around LA to go house to house, block to block, to put together any note they wanted, to leave their name for the crew of Apollo 11 and put together in this incredible big book. And this is actually really important for the project that this, when I first saw this page in particular, and I
this
saw,
first page here.
Yeah, Robert Ibarra. And I saw his name was written quite large. And then above it, he wrote, "I'll never make it, so I'll make it big." And that was the crux in many ways of the project for me, was that, the you know, this desire that if we could just write our names big enough that we'll be remembered.
Josh says it was apparent by way of collecting these autographs that Charles Loomis was making a name for himself. And that want, that need, well, we all have it to some degree.
You have an interesting take on the autograph and what it means for us, why there's always been such a lure to have them. What does it really say about us, this need to have a piece of someone this way?
Well, I want to flip it back to you. I mean, what, you know, the fact that after all these years, Isaiah Thomas has escaped your autograph grasp, right? It's because we, on the one hand, if you're asking someone for their autograph, we tend to be asking for those who keep autograph books, let's say, or want an autograph from their favorite fill-in-the-blank, favorite chef, favorite actor, favorite athlete, is that we want to have something that's left in their hand that they touch that comes back with us into our kind of space of intimacy, like back into an autograph book that might go in a drawer in your bedroom. It's a piece of them that becomes a piece of you and yes. becomes part of your biography, our biographies, much in the way a favorite song will or a favorite film can just to kind of take residence in our lives. And so I think that that's been a key drive for collecting autographs. The other piece that we look at in this project is not just collecting autographs of the famous or the known, is the other desire, which is why we all feel that we want to leave our autographs, which is to say on everything from, you know, a wet piece of sidewalk, we want to leave our initials, that's carve right. our names in a tree,
yeah.
But also the long history of writing on the built environment. And that goes back to, you know, centuries back to, you know, to cave paintings and cave drawings, to Native American, you know, wall art and wall drawings and rock art, up through graffiti and tagging and gang script and on and on and on. And so we do the kind of collective wisdom that was produced in doing this book was this idea that we have an innate desire to leave our mark on the world that is around us, the public environment around us. We want people to know we were here and maybe outlast this present moment.
Is there a shift, though, in what we're thinking of as that mark? I'm thinking about the selfie. And Elizabeth Warren, presidential candidate, has these selfie lines. Very few people are asking her for her autograph. Everyone wants to capture a photo of her.
Yeah. This is the challenge right now, is that what's happening with the autograph? What's happening with the signature? Because at the same time that people are wanting selfies, perhaps, and not her autograph, is also the same time that, you know, we're signing documents digitally. We're using DocuSign or another digital software, and you know, we're not writing as much to begin with. The very notion of script or, you know, handwritten text is not something, you know, most of our writing has gotten horrible. But I don't know, I think that instead of seeing them as separate, I actually see them as part of the same story. It's a continuum of wanting to be seen. And so I think there is something at work there with the selfie, but also the digital tag, not the graffiti tag on a wall. But the digital tag, like, oh, I'm going to take a picture and I'm going to tag people in it. And sometimes you tag people who are in the picture. But as we all know, in our weakest moments, we tag people who we want to see that picture
yes.
and try to actually create a community of renown around us. Mm-hmm. So it's the same ideas with different technologies. I didn't want this project to be a kind of back in the day when autographs
yeah.
were a great project, but more about let's think about this larger universal idea of the desire to leave our mark on the city we live in and on the time that we're here.
Have you ever thought about how we yearn to leave our mark on the places, you know, the cities and towns we call home? In curating this autograph collection, Josh started thinking about the ways his home, LA, is changing.
Los Angeles was and continues to be going through one of many periods of intense gentrification and neighborhood displacement. that has been really painful for lots of communities, predominantly communities of color around Los Angeles. And a lot of that is about what gets erased when people move, when people are forced to leave their homes and forced to leave their neighborhoods. Like, what happens to those stories? And if they left marks there, where are those marks? And what storefronts are left and what storefronts are covered over? And all these questions around the politics of memory. And so this really is...
questions that all over the world absolutely. People are grappling with.
Absolutely. That's something as simple and as small as, can I get your autograph, or I'm going to write my name on the desk in school or something like that. Something as simple as that. Like, we do this every day, mm-hmm. right? It's so instinctual. We want to leave our mark. We want to leave our name.
Back at the exhibit.
That's the illustrator from the original Jungle Book.
There are all here. Of the famous and notable autographs collector Loomis spent his life gathering. But in curating this exhibit, Kuhn was also thinking about all of the names we'll never see.
You know, you have to deal with what you have and what's in front of you, which is thrilling and exciting. And the more you work with it, though, you realize you're also looking at a record of what's not there and what's missing. And you realize the obvious thing is that all archives and all collections are not, you know, kind of these natural formations that just appear out of right. the air. They're curated. They are, you know, the result of individuals who make choices about what to collect and why. Sometimes you know the rationale, sometimes you don't. And so my goal has been to take it at face value first and say, what's here? What are the stories that it's telling? And then say, all right, what are the stories that are missing? Whose voices, whose names? And the projects become kind of referendums mm-hmm. on the politics of archiving themselves, I'd say.
Improve upon the page. Remember, that's what collector Loomis would say to all those famous folks he'd send blank pages to. Kuhn loved that idea, but with a twist.
We had an autograph day last year where we asked anyone in Los Angeles who wanted to come to branch libraries, how would you improve upon the page of the city? And anyone could fill out the autograph. So we also include those autographs in this exhibit. So it's the people who counted in 1906, and now it's anyone in Los Angeles who came in. They too count, and their voices are on the walls here.
Josh Kuhn, director of the USC Annenberg School of Communication. Josh, thanks for joining us. Can I have your autograph?
Of course.
I'm serious. I want your autograph.
Think I'll let her keep on going wherever it is she's going to.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
European Union ambassadors agreed today to grant the United Kingdom a Brexit extension beyond next Thursday, but they haven't said how long that extension will be. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said yesterday he'll give Parliament more time to debate his Brexit deal, but only if lawmakers approve an early general election. Let's bring in BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Hi, Rob.
Hi there, Jeremy. Things as clear as ever on Brexit.
They never do seem to clear up. Can we say for sure, though, that the UK is not going to crash out of the EU without a deal next Thursday?
I think that does seem amazingly unlikely, despite Boris Johnson's rather unwise promise that he would rather die in a ditch than agree to an extension of the Brexit process. Oops.
So what happens next in Parliament then?
Goodness gracious. Well, the most important thing is to find out whether or not MPs are prepared to vote for a general election, as Mr. Johnson has proposed on the 12th of December. And I have absolutely no idea whether they will or not. I mean, I think it's amazingly unlikely that opposition parties will agree to do things exactly as Boris Johnson wants. But, I mean, can they keep putting off an election forever? Probably not.
So if they say no next week to a general election, then what happens?
Well, I suspect there'll be a sort of a haggle over what to do next. But it's important to remember this. Why do the Conservatives and Mr. Johnson want a general election? And no one's going to be surprised, because the opinion polls suggest they would win. Mm-hmm. Why does the main opposition party a bit more reluctant? Because they have seen the same polls, Jeremy. I mean, it's difficult to see exactly what the way forward is on this. I mean, I suspect that the leader of the opposition party, Jeremy Corbyn, is that sort of chap. I think he's rather looking forward to some kind of campaign. But those in his party are saying, look, hang on a minute. This is, look at the polls. We'd be absolutely crazy. Let's either A, try and get a second referendum first ahead of a general election, or sort of just play a long game, just delay and delay and delay and hope that something turns up.
Is a general election, if one happens soon, really like a second referendum, though? A lot of people have made that case that kind of is a referendum. You either say, I'm with you, Boris Johnson, I want to get out, or I'm against you, Boris Johnson, I don't want Britain to leave the European Union.
I think the answer is yes and no. I mean, I think that's certainly the way the Conservative Party would like it, because their message is going to be, you know, we are the party to get Brexit done. I should say, by the way, in parenthesis, that it's a rather effective, if immensely disingenuous, message, in that we'll be discussing our relationship with the European Union for decades to come, mm-hmm. whether there's a deal or not. But that's what Mr. Johnson wants. And two of the opposition parties, the Scottish Nationalists and the Liberal Democrats, they are out and out, let's reverse Brexit parties. But it's different with the other party, the main opposition, Labour Party. And here's the thing, you know, whether you want it to be about Brexit or not exclusively a general election, that's just not the way elections work. I mean, look, it involves 45 million eligible voters. Anything could happen. No doubt other issues, other events may intrude. And that's the way, of course, in which, you know, you might argue, yes, you could have a general election, but it could settle nothing in a couple of ways, in that one party may not get an absolute majority. And you go back to this, what we've just been discussing, that you'll have this sort of sense, well, actually, did it really settle Brexit?
That's BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. We will be seeing you next week in London. Rob, get the beer to room temperature for us. I know that's how you like it in the UK.
It's already there, Jeremy.
Haiti is in the midst of a political and humanitarian crisis. For weeks, thousands of people have flooded the streets of Port-au-Prince, protesting fuel shortages and demanding their president, Jovenel Moïse, step down. Let's bring in Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. She's been covering the volatile situation in Haiti. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. So we have been looking at these stunning and really disturbing photos and videos of people in the streets burning tires. The country really seems to be at a standstill. Give us a sense of the magnitude of these demonstrations.
Well, we are currently in week 6 of demonstrations, and the opposition just announced additional demonstrations to begin on Sunday for a week. But what's happened is that it's all around the country. It's just not in the capital of Port-au-Prince, but it's in Cape Haitien in the north, it's in Lakai in the south, and you have parts of this country that are just completely cut off, barricaded. Just don't have walls of burning fires, but you have huge boulders that are put into the streets. You have tree trunks, you have vehicles, you have ditches. Literally what's been going on now is that you have a humanitarian crisis brewing, because nothing can get in and nothing can get out.
And no access to food and water and those things.
Exactly. And fuel. I mean, that's very important. I mean, I've seen reports where there is a hospital in the far reaches of the country, the western parts, that announced that it was shutting its door because it's run out of fuel. Basically, what you have is the opposition, along with other groups in civil society, including religious leaders. The Catholic Church itself just had a huge protest this week. They're asking for the president to resign. They're saying that the country has been mismanaged in terms of the economics. The inflation right now is over 20%. But you have on the streets just call for Haitians from all passive life that are just basically asking for a change in the system, saying that
and
this is not
And just to clarify, why do they specifically want the president to go? And is it the only thing that they're demanding?
No. So initially, this started off with you had the traditional opposition that was, you know, saying the president has to go. And then what you had was the equivalent of our GAO, the government auditors, that did a report on a subsidized oil program from Venezuela called Petrocaribe. And during that audit, what we found, or what they found, is that billions of dollars in aid that should have gone to help the poor, especially after the 2010 earthquake, was basically wasted by the government, the previous government, and their supporters. And in fact, they used the word embezzled in their report. President Jovenel Moïse was not president at the time, but what they also allege is that two companies associated with him, one that he was the president of, the other one that he was associated with, received government contracts for roads, and that job was not done. And so he's being accused of being part of this embezzlement scheme. That right there just ignited the calls. So you've got the corruption charges on top of what's happening in the economy right now and the country just not being governed.
And just last week, the UN ended its 15-year peacekeeping presence in Haiti. That was 6,200 Blue Helmet soldiers and more than 1,000 police officers that had been deployed there to restore order back in 2004. There's really this big looming question, though, and it's probably more difficult to answer. What would a more inclusive, just society for Haitians look like? Who would replace Moïse if he were to leave office?
So the Constitution right now is silent on this issue. There are a couple of proposals. And what the proposal is, because you asked, what do they want? They just don't want for President Moïse to step down, but they want it to be an orderly resignation. But the push also is for transition, that Haiti needs at least several months or maybe several years where they redo their constitution and they address some of the institutional weaknesses that seem to repeatedly bring the country to a point where it is today. Let me just mention, for instance, in January, as of the second Monday in January, President Moïse will probably be one of 20 elected officials in that whole country, him plus 19 senators. Everybody else, their terms will be finished.
So much chaos and conflict and rebuilding of a nation. That's Jacqueline Charles, the Miami Herald's Caribbean correspondent who's been covering the political crisis unfolding in Haiti. Thank you so much for joining us, Jacqueline.
Thanks for having me.
What becomes of a sacred place when it also happens to be the location of a mass shooting? This is the question facing the leadership of the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, where 11 Jewish worshipers were murdered a year ago this Sunday. As Liz Reed of WESA reports, places of worship that have faced similar attacks share a common conviction: they will not be moved.
A chain link fence has blocked off the entrance to the Tree of Life Synagogue for nearly a year now. The imposing concrete building was constructed in the 1950s. Inside the 1,400-seat sanctuary, huge stained glass windows illustrate the story of creation and remind worshipers of their responsibility to care for the earth and one another. But no one has worshipped here since October 27th, 2018.
I cannot go in there now.
Andrea Wedner's mother, Rose Malinger, was killed on that day during Saturday morning services.
I've said that I will go back in that building if it looks totally different.
Wedner is not alone. Sam Schachner, president of Tree of Life or La Simcha congregation, says they began holding listening sessions to discuss what to do with the building early this year. He says some were concerned that making only small fixes in the sanctuary could cause people's imaginations to run wild, recreating in their minds the scene from that deadly day.
Because most people are not aware what actually happened in the site, and yet they're aware of what was there, so they would approximately know where somebody was by what had changed.
But Schachner says others have pushed for a return to the existing synagogue, particularly those who have attended for many decades. While they haven't yet determined the extent of repairs and renovations or whether the building will be demolished altogether, Tree of Life leadership recently announced that the congregation will return to the site. Andrea Wedner says that's what her mother would have wanted.
I don't want this person to win. I don't want what happened to take away our home.
There's no template for how to move forward when an act of violence occurs in a house of worship. On Wednesday, September 15, 1999, a gunman entered Wedgwood Baptist Church in Fort Worth, Texas. In less than 10 minutes, seven people were dead. Debbie Gillette has been an employee and member of Wedgwood Baptist for more than three decades. She says there was no question that they would continue to hold services in the space.
We met our pastor's house, had a time of prayer, and we just decided that that was what we needed to do. Our pastor said, you know, he spoke out first saying he thought that's what the Lord wanted us to do, and we just all agreed.
After the bullet holes in the walls were fixed and the bloodstained carpet was replaced, congregants returned to the sanctuary for worship the very next Sunday. But when four black girls were killed in a bombing at 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, the building was closed for 8 months. When it did reopen, it looked pretty much the same, says current pastor Reverend Arthur Price, save for a few modifications.
The bathroom where the girls were found in, it was moved. That particular portion of the church was sealed off.
Some families of the murdered children never returned to the church. But nearly 60 years after that racist attack, says Price, congregants don't think of the space as a place of violence and trauma, but rather one of renewal and reconciliation.
Many people that worship here, they do feel the burden of the legacy of 16th Street Baptist Church. Many feel honored and feel that responsibility that worship must continue to go on in this space and in this place.
You know, unfortunately, we're going to have to become that too, probably.
Barb Feig is Tree of Life's executive director.
It's not something we're going to plan, but I think the rest of the world will make us this historic site now.
Over the past 9 months, members and leadership of Tree of Life have developed an ambitious and expansive vision for the synagogue. Not only will it have worship space for Tree of Life and other congregations, but it could also become home to the Holocaust Center of Pittsburgh. And there will be a memorial to the 11 victims. While the details have yet to be worked out, Tree of Life Rabbi Jeffrey Myers said in a press release that the synagogue is poised to become an incredible center for Jewish life in the United States. Quote, I want the entire world to say, wow, look at what they have done. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Reed in Pittsburgh.
Chinese officials said today they're working to identify the 39 people found dead in a truck in the UK this week. Police discovered the bodies of 8 women and 31 men in the back of a refrigerated trailer in Essex on Wednesday. Most are believed to be Chinese nationals. Pippa Mills is Deputy Chief Constable with the Essex Police.
This matter has attracted national and international interest, and it's absolutely imperative that the operation is conducted with the utmost respect for the 39 people who've lost their lives.
The case has renewed concerns over human trafficking, although the details of this case are not yet known. And for more, we're joined now by Stephanie Hepburn, journalist and co-author of the book Human Trafficking Around the World, Hidden in Plain Sight. Stephanie, we don't know whether the people in the back of this truck were smuggled or were being trafficked, but what is the difference between the two?
That's a great question. So the crux of human trafficking is really deprivation of freedom and that deprivation being done for an exploitative purpose. And right now we don't know about an exploitative purpose. So we do know that people were transported and that tragedy occurred and that they died. And we don't really even know how they died, if it was suffocation or if it was the temperature was so low that they died that way. But, you know, like I said, there are so many more questions than answers. But what we do know is that when it comes to human trafficking, the crux of it is really that deprivation of freedom happens for an exploitative purpose.
Like what?
So that can be, you know, in my mind, that's forced labor. And that forced labor can be for the purposes of commercial sexual exploitation. It can be for domestic labor. It can be for forced agricultural labor. It can be for any type of labor that somebody signed on to do oftentimes, but their freedom is deprived, meaning they are unable to move. Whether that's they're not paid, whether their identifying documentation is withheld, there are so many different ways that that can transpire. And over the years, we've learned more and more about what coercion looks like.
But if somebody is being trafficked, Do they have any sense in the beginning, if you say they may have signed on to coming in to do labor of some kind, do they have any sense of the risks that are involved with that? And they think, well, I'm in such a desperate situation, I have to just take this risk? Or do they think it's going to be easier or less risky than it ends up being?
I mean, I think that's an excellent question. I think that's a gray zone. I think many people know, you know, we're talking, and I think the highlighting of desperation is immensely critical, because when you are in a desperate situation, whether you're marginalized or there's civil unrest, or, you know, I live in New Orleans, whether there is a hurricane that has ravaged the city, leaving a disrupted infrastructure and a sudden demand for low-cost labor, you have scenarios where certainly people are cognizant that there are some risks, but you have unscrupulous people who are good at conveying opportunity. And when people are desperate, opportunity sounds pretty good. So I think it's some combination of those two. I think people are aware that there are risks and they're willing to take those risks because they're desperate.
Whose responsibility is it to stop this kind of trafficking?
So I think that's very layered. You know, I think that we as a society need to be more cognizant of it. I think we need to realize that this is not an other issue, meaning a problem that's happening elsewhere, so not our problem. So I think it needs to be addressed on the local level. There needs to be policy that's passed. I think when we're looking at supply chain transparency, making sure that, you know, what happens in that chain, what happens, you know, when we're following that thread along the way to make sure that people are treated right.
Were you surprised that that truck was obviously able to make it across borders, potentially
right,
with so many people in the back, and not be discovered along the way?
Yeah, I mean, what I read was that because it's a refrigerated vehicle, they need to just make sure that it was closed properly. And I think what you're highlighting is points of vulnerability. And that's exactly right. And when we're talking about the supply chain, you know, those points are exactly where we need to press to make sure that people aren't vulnerable and that they're harm is not coming to them, and that there are checkpoints, like you said.
Stephanie, do you think that it's possible, or likely even, that right now as we speak, there's a truck just like that driving around the United States with people in the back of it that nobody knows
about? Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that we see this over and over again. It doesn't matter whether you're in the UK, whether you're in China, whether you're in the United States, you know, people are desperate for a better situation. And there are going to be unscrupulous people who step into that space and take advantage. And I fully think that that is happening at this moment.
That is Stephanie Hepburn, who is a journalist and co-author of the book Human Trafficking Around the World, Hidden in Plain Sight. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. I'm Tanya Mosley. Children living in poverty is now a major policy issue for some presidential candidates. We speak with an expert about the state of poverty in our country.
If you think about a family or a household budget, healthcare is one of the high costs. Childcare is another high cost. And so thinking about how does a family that's struggling make those choices?
Next time on Here and Now.